It's the Confluence where the news comes together on 90.5 WESA. I'm Kevin Gavin. Earlier this month, Pittsburgh Mayor Bill Peduto received a letter from Kevin McMahon, CEO of the Pittsburgh Cultural Trust, citing, quote, a declining level of public safety in the cultural district, end quote. Mr. McMahon's letter indicated a double shooting on the 4th of July was not isolated, that there have been drug overdoses, assaults, and aggressive panhandling. I spoke with the mayor in his office on Friday.
Mayor Peduto, welcome to the Confluence.
Thanks, Kevin.
Mayor, are you concerned about the level of safety downtown, particularly in the cultural district?
Well, we look at it across the entire city. So when we look at statistics, we try to find where crime is trending. When it starts to trend in a specific area, we have specific plans for those areas and on a general keeping the crime numbers low. Since 2014, every year our homicide rate has gone down. The amount of violent crime has also been decreasing. In some areas and in downtown, we see spikes, but they're usually around events and they're usually targeted to specific individuals, not random crime. What Mr. McMahon's talking about with the number of panhandlers, the number of homeless, the number of people who are addicted is a trend that we're not only seeing in Pittsburgh and southwestern Pennsylvania, but all throughout the United States. What we do with our homeless is we work in combination between organizations like Mercy Behavioral and the Department of Human Services with the county, and we have plans in place to help to find them homes within 90 days. Now, I realize that may be an inconvenience that some who are coming into the city for a theater or a symphony show might not want to see, but it's the reality of the country that we live in at this moment.
Even as numbers have declined, as you cited, overall, does that make people feel better when they perceive trouble, when they perceive trouble on the horizon?
Right. No. I mean, obviously, there's two parts of it. It's the reality of violent crime, homicide, and being able to work through those through a proactive police department. And then there's the second one of the perception. When you look at an area like the Cultural Trust and you start to see the conditions of our society, you see people who are addicted to painkillers. You see people who are panhandling to pay for addiction. You see people who are homeless. You begin to feel that that area is unsafe. We work on working to help those people to be able to help them to solve their own problems.
Mr. McMahon's letter said crime could undo the reputation his offices help work to create. Should there be greater concern for one part of the city, the cultural district, compared to other sites, whether it's the North Side, Homewood, name the neighborhood?
No, there shouldn't. And sure, he should try to be a representative of the cultural district, just as neighborhood leaders should be the representatives of their own neighborhoods. But in many times, you get better results by using a telephone instead of a megaphone.
Have you talked with Mr. McMahon?
I have not talked to Mr. McMahon because I don't believe in his way of trying to communicate. I think his board should talk to him.
Our guest on the Confluence is Mayor Bill Peduto. Your administration scored a recent victory in the state Supreme Court when the High Court ruled the city did not overstep its authority with the 2015 ordinance requiring employers to provide paid sick leave. It's been a four-year battle with some businesses in the city. Why did you think this was important to challenge the restrictions on what local government could or couldn't do?
Well, again, you know, there are those that are saying it's not the role of local government to challenge laws, especially laws that affect guns or workers. We argue quite the opposite, and we believe that that's the only way the change actually occurs. Why did we do it? Two reasons. Number one, the vast majority of Pittsburghers believe in it, in that the public safety of this city is paramount. And they also know that this city has a long history of supporting workers' rights. And when your child is sick and you are forced to go to work or to take a vacation day. Or if you yourself are sick and you're going into work and you're working with an industry that deals with the public, you're spreading that disease throughout the public. The second point is that there are over 47,000 workers in the city of Pittsburgh that this will affect. 47,000 workers that don't have paid sick leave. And if the state won't address the issue or is completely opposed to the issue, if the Chamber of Commerce is fighting the issue from ever coming up in Washington, then it becomes incumbent upon local government to be able to start to create the change.
The decision by the Supreme Court regarding paid sick leave noted that the burden on businesses presented is not insignificant. So what do you say to businesses in the city that says this is going to hurt us?
Well, it should be something that you're giving to the people that you consider absolutely vital to your business at the beginning. We should never have to go through government in order to try and get laws that guarantee people when they're sick, they don't have to show up to work. Or if they are so sick they can't get to work, that they're forced to take their vacation time. This is a common sense measure that you should be offering your workers. And if you aren't offering this to your workers, are you letting your customers know it? And if you're not letting your customers know it because you think it may hurt business, well, then think of that as what is hurting your business and not the fact that you're treating your employees without the due respect that they have earned.
Mayor Peduto, last week, City Council passed and you signed a special zoning designation for Lawrenceville to increase affordable housing. New developments, at least 20 units, would have to have at least 10% be affordable housing. You and many leaders that I've spoken with have noted the need for thousands of units of affordable housing. Is this the most effective way to meet that need, sort of maybe a patchwork of programs in the community here and there, in this neighborhood and that neighborhood?
That's actually the best way of describing it. There is not a one-size-fits-all that you can just slap a policy in place that will create affordable housing in any city, because you're dealing with separate micro-economies. So what's happening in Lawrenceville is very different than what's happening in Knoxville. What's happening in East Liberty is very different than what's happening in Sheridan. In each of these neighborhoods need two things. The first, they need the ability to have a community plan of what the neighbors want to see their neighborhood look like in the next 10 years, the next 20 years, and what the priorities of that would be, all the way down to identifying the most significant burdensome houses or vacant properties within the neighborhood so they can see those results occur over the next few years as well. And number two, they need a toolbox in order to be able to do it. In Lawrenceville, what the community wanted to see was, with all this new development that's occurring, there needs to be a component of it that will remain affordable based upon the income of the area today.
So how does that not negatively impact people who are already residents?
Let me say this about that too. We need to build apartment buildings and, at the second track, build affordability. You have to run both tracks. And when we build the buildings, we have to keep within the city a 10 to 15% vacancy rate in order for the developers then to compete with lower rent in order to be able to try to attract people into their buildings. If we're at 100% capacity, we are going to see hyperinflation of rent. So we have to constantly build new apartment buildings throughout the city in order to keep rent lower.
But what if the landlord of an existing building says, hey, I see this new development, they're getting this much for their units, I can jump up mine even if property assessments don't go up?
Well, again, that will happen. But the counterpoint to that is, if there is no supply, that landlord will be able to leapfrog the rent in order to be able to get the demand. And at the same time, people will begin to bid at a very high rate. But last year, the national organization which studies rent prices by neighborhoods looked at what the national increase of rent was by neighborhood. And in the city of Pittsburgh, 85 of the 90 neighborhoods had rent increases less than the national average. We have a housing policy which allows us to build much more affordable housing than we have in the past, and at the same time build market rate housing in order to be able to keep an ample supply to meet demand.
Can you give us an idea of how many units of affordable housing have been created during your administration toward that overall need of thousands of units? Are you satisfied with the progress of sort of meeting that need?
So that's a question I ask often, and I still haven't gotten an answer. We have been successful in building affordable housings through traditional means, meaning low-income tax credits. They're basically given by the state, about four of them per year. We now have the governor giving us five that help to build low-income housing, quality low-income housing, I should add, throughout the city, about five projects a year, several hundred units per year. And then we also have been able to work with specific developers of having percentages of low-income housing on a voluntary basis to help to supplement that. We've also created a trust fund of $10 million a year in order to be able to incentivize different types of programs for those that are being affected by higher rent increases, but also additional housing. However, we have not done a good enough job on untraditional means. And what I mean by that is we have 17,000 vacant lots and properties and abandoned homes and condemned buildings all throughout the city that are ours. And we need to be able to connect them with nonprofit agencies, community development corporations, faith-based institutions, and others, in using them to become training grounds for the next round of electricians, roofers, drywall hangers, window installers, plumbers, get people from the neighborhood revitalizing these homes and then putting them back on the tax rolls as properties that are for sale to lower income individuals.
Pittsburgh Mayor Bill Peduto, thanks so much.
Thank you.
I'm Kevin Gavin. You're listening to The Confluence on 90.5 WESA.
I'm Kylie Kaczynski. Still ahead on The Confluence, a Philadelphia refinery heavily damaged by an explosion is closing and taking 1,000 jobs with it. But some neighbors are cheering on the end of the East Coast's largest refinery. Then a new summer program gives kids access to backpacks full of lessons about the environment and wildlife around Allegheny County. And the Port Authority says it won't cooperate with Immigration and Customs Enforcement agents in their efforts to locate undocumented residents. You can find conversations, stories, and more from this and past episodes of The Confluence on our website at wesa.fm/confluence.
I'm Katie Blackley with the Pittsburgh Almanac. This week in history, flood control measures are announced and celebrated in the region in 1937. Then Congressman J. Buell Snyder appropriated $105 million to assess flood-prone regions, make infrastructure improvements, and institute proactive measures. Significant floods earlier that year and the year before did more than $1 billion in damage to Ohio Valley communities. Much of the funds were dedicated to improving the region's lock and dam system. That's today's Pittsburgh Almanac.
WESA celebrates 90 neighborhoods, 90 good stories, a weekly series about people who make the place they live a better place to live.
It's The Confluence on 90.5 WESA. I'm Kevin Gavin. Homewood fiber artist Tina Brewer spoke with 90.5 WESA's Elaine Effort about the quilting technique that she has shared for decades with seniors, students, and other artists.
Tina Brewer, you are celebrated for your story quilts. Whose stories are you telling?
I'm telling the stories of our ancestors, and I come from a family where I sat at the kitchen table and ate food and listened to the stories, and that's how they communicated our history to us about the family. So as I started to pick up my pieces and started to quilt, I thought it would be important to use that as an impetus to tell the stories so that people won't be forgotten. And I've been working pretty much since 1985 on the Middle Passage, and I have tried to capture the history from the Middle Passage going backwards instead of forwards, to say what we brought to this country rather than what they say about us in this country.
What did it mean to you to receive the Commonwealth of Pennsylvania Governor's Award for the Arts, being named Artist of the Year for 2018?
I was overwhelmed by it because, of course, everyone works hard. My work, I think, is good. It speaks to the importance to my community and my people, but to have it be acknowledged by the greater community is important. It really took me back, and so I'm forever grateful. I've been working with the Pennsylvania Council on the Arts for about 20 years. I worked with the Society for Contemporary Crafts for 23 years. And for that time, I've done community work. So I've been working as a community artist for about 23 years. And so you just do that work and love that work. And then to have somebody pick it up and say, you know, this is worthy of a celebration, makes my heart.
Who influenced you the most?
When I first started out, my father-in-law really influenced me in terms of capturing that ancient history. And then the ancient African history classes that were at the Homewood Library was inspirational as well. But the technique that I used is one that I've made up. So I still do a lot of scrapping because it's important to use fabric that comes with its own energy. So I love to use, like I made some quilts from my father-in-law's ties, from old scraps of fabric from my family members. So I kind of repurpose. So we've been repurposing for a long time.
It's also important to you that you share and you work with others and you teach.
And I think that comes from my upbringing. The more you give, the more you receive. You know, I am a teacher who teaches everything that I know, and I give it over to you, and something new comes. And so I'm not afraid to let it all be practiced by other artists, and then I enjoy their success.
Tina Brewer, thank you for taking time to do this interview.
You're welcome. Thank you so much. It's my pleasure.
You're listening to The Confluence on 90.5 WESA. It's The Confluence on 90.5 WESA. I'm Kevin Gavin. The Philadelphia Energy Solutions oil refinery filed for bankruptcy last week. An explosion and fire that tore through the facility in June led the cash-strapped company to close. More than 1,000 people will lose their jobs. But some neighbors have cheered the end to the 150-year-old refinery, the largest on the East Coast. For State Impact Pennsylvania, Emily Pontecorvo reports on how the planned closure has sparked discussions on what a future without fossil fuel production could look like.
The closure of the largest oil refinery on the East Coast surprised everyone. It devastated refinery workers who, just days before, secured the facility and kept the city safe. Philadelphia Energy Solutions operator Brandon Peters says the refinery feels like home.
I love working at that refinery. I am heartbroken that it's over.
Peters Union, Steelworkers Local 101, wants a buyer to restart the facility. But residents living near the refinery complained for years about pollution that they say impacted their health. South Philadelphia resident Irene Russell is happy about the plant's closure.
I'm glad that happened. It needed to happen. And they ain't never got to open back up as far as I'm concerned, really.
Right now, the future of the 1,400-acre site is up in the air. And in a way, these very different views of what should happen next reflect a conversation that's taking place all over the country right now. How to transition away from fossil fuels and at the same time protect the good-paying jobs that fossil fuel production provides. Some advocates say that we can do both, and they call it a just transition. To be clear, the refinery did not shut down to cut carbon emissions, but a local environmental justice group called Philly Thrive sees the refinery's closure as a chance to talk about the so-called just transition. Organizer Alexa Ross is running an online petition to campaign for the idea.
We're currently, I just refreshed the page, we're at 298 signatures of Philadelphians who have said we want to just transition at the refinery.
Ross says the community should have a voice in determining the future of the refinery site. After all, at 1,400 acres, it's about the same size as Center City, Philadelphia. Her vision also includes training and financial support for workers. Refinery workers like Anna Maria Boyce want a job that pays well.
I'm sure whatever training that will be offered is not going to be equitable to what we have here. We're not going to make the same money.
Union refinery operators make between $70,000 and $120,000 a year. That's more than double what some jobs in renewable energy pay.
Transitioning away from a fossil fuel-based economy is going to involve pain. And who bears that pain, and when does it happen?
Patrick Young is a former organizer for the United Steelworkers in Pittsburgh. He actually worked on the campaign to save the South Philadelphia refinery when it almost closed back in 2011. Today, the steelworkers aren't talking about a just transition. They just want the refinery to stay open. But Young says the idea actually has roots in the labor movement.
A guy named Tony Mazzocchi, who was a leader, a really visionary leader in the oil, chemical, and atomic workers, really jumped onto the frame of a just transition.
Young says that in the 1990s, Mazzocchi realized the country would need to move away from fossil fuels because of climate change. He coined the term and the key ideas of a just transition.
Ideally, one of the principles of just transition is that people have time and early warning to realize the refinery that I'm working in is closing. It's closing in 4 years. And I can start making plans for what my life looks like in 5 years, 6 years, 7 years, and 8 years.
Obviously, that's not what happened in this case. 4 days after the explosion, workers read in a news report that they would lose their jobs. Young says that's why, if the refinery remains closed, Philadelphia Energy Solutions cannot be a good example of a just transition.
You know, that's just going to make everybody who works in the energy sector that much more terrified that, like, okay, well, if this is a just transition, what the hell is an unjust transition?
Still, some say our future depends on shutting down fossil fuel plants. South Philadelphia resident Shamar Pitts lives near the refinery, and he's not just concerned about air pollution. He's also worried about the increase in extreme hot weather and storms caused by climate change. Pitts says there is no win-win situation for his neighborhood and for the workers right now. But he's got a 6-week-old daughter, and he's worried about her future.
We care about the workers, but we have to change. There's no way we can go on like this. We won't survive.
The mayor's office has formed a working group to determine next steps for the refinery site. The group will hold its first public meeting later this month.
For State Impact Pennsylvania, Emily Pontecorvo.
And I'm Kevin Gavin. You're listening to The Confluence on 90.5 WESA.
It's The Confluence, where the news comes together on 90.5 WESA. I'm Megan Harris. Summer is in full swing, and Allegheny County is abuzz with wildlife ripe for exploring. But how are parents and educators getting kids outside to explore in less structured settings? Allegheny County, joined by the Land Trust, Library Association, and the Western Pennsylvania Conservancy, have launched a Nature Explorer backpack program in 36 county libraries and counting. Carrie Lane is the Youth Services Coordinator at the Library Association. Carrie, thanks so much for joining us.
It's great to be here. Thanks for having me.
So what exactly is the backpack program and what does it entail?
So this project stemmed from a partnership with the Western Pennsylvania Conservancy, and the main goal is just to get kids exploring out in nature. And if you talk to the Conservancy, sometimes they give the example, if you ask a child what their favorite animal is, they're going to say a dolphin or a tiger. And if you really think about it, they're not going to see that in their backyard. So these backpacks are reflective of what they will see in their backyard in Western Pennsylvania or one of the Allegheny County parks or any other of our natural assets here in Western Pennsylvania.
And the backpacks themselves, they're all themed, right?
Yes. There's five themes: wildlife, water, land, cultural, and plants. So then the sub-themes all fall into those. So
like wildflowers, butterflies, that kind of thing?
Yes. So the wildflowers obviously is one of the plant ones, and that's great because then it's connecting kids to, there's meadows in some of the county parks. They're developing more meadows in some of the county parks. So it's getting families out and exploring that and seeing what is used in a meadow and what is considered a wildflower.
So inside the backpacks themselves, what are we talking about? Field guides, magnifying glasses, what do they look like?
Every bag is different. So they all have a bright orange messenger bag. And inside that bag, there is a folder for the parent or the child if they're at reading level. And inside that folder is a guide to whatever they're exploring. That guide includes a welcome. It includes what's inside the kit. It has tips for finding whatever they're looking for. Just tips on how to explore and put back whatever you might take from nature. There are journal prompts on there because each child that takes it out gets a journal they get to keep. And so then they can write about what they're exploring. And then also in that is a poison ivy guide, tick guide, the field guides for whatever the theme is. Some will have multiple field guides if it's a bigger theme. Ethics card for exploring. So that's all in the like packet of information. And then there is, depending on what the theme is, there might be a magnifying glass, there might be binoculars. The birding one has an identifier, which is a really cool manipulative for exploring birds. And it has different buttons so you can hear different bird calls. So then they can maybe match it up if they're at maybe Beechwood Farms or Harrison Hills, which are great birding sites.
How many backpacks are there spread across the county total?
Right now, I think we have 35. So they're at the county libraries. And we tried to organize them so that there is one of each theme in each region of the county. So then if someone lives in the East region, they might be able to find those all close by. But also, just because we have such a great system, if they put on hold this backpack at Robinson and this bag lives at Monroeville, it can be sent to their library at Robinson.
So 35 backpacks, 12 sub themes. That's lots and lots of backpacks floating out there.
Yes.
Do you have any idea yet which one is the most popular?
I would say wetlands is really popular, but bugs is pretty popular too.
What are age groups are these designed for?
We would like them to be for elementary, but they can be scaled. Like an adult could take them out. I mean, our goal is for families to use them, and families can use them with young children. They just maybe need a little bit more explanation. But anyone can take these out. We just want people out exploring.
It's The Confluence on 90.5 WESA. I'm Megan Harris, and we're talking with Carrie Lane of the Allegheny County Library Association about its new Nature Explorer Backpack Program. Carrie, this is the first year for the backpack program, right? How did it get started?
We met with the Western Pennsylvania Conservancy, and we just talked about ways we could work together, and a nature backpack idea was one of those. And I've worked before with the Allegheny County Parks, so we thought that would be a great addition to bring them in. And then we thought about the Allegheny Land Trust as well. And so the four of us have worked together to create these backpacks. And then also it's great because I think when people think of a county park, a child might only think of a playground. But this is really getting them out and exploring, and it's also getting them maybe out to properties and natural assets that they hadn't thought about in the past.
Some of those properties and natural assets, are any of the backpacks designed around specific points of interest? Maybe like not quite tourism, but sort of tourism?
Okay, so some of the bags are very specific for a certain park or property, but that doesn't mean you couldn't take it and use it in your backyard. So for example, Upper St. Clair has a wetlands bag as well, and they are connected with Wingfield Pines. So those families might take it there, and there'll be specific information in that bag about that property of the Allegheny Land Trust. A big thing with these bags, yes, they do connect to certain parks or properties, but we also want to remember that some of our patrons who might be checking this out have transportation barriers or might live in a more urban setting, and you can use this in a puddle or a pothole, and you can find something living in there possibly. Or there might be, if you take the wildflower one out, you can go to an abandoned parking lot and there might be numerous species of wildflowers in that parking lot. So we also want people to remember, like, you might not have the ability to get to one of these parks, but you can use it anywhere, even in your backyard.
As you're exploring this, you know, from a youth perspective and someone who works with children all the time, how much of this is designed around trying to combat, I guess, some of that summer brain drain that happens between semesters from the spring to the fall?
Right. Well, libraries obviously are known for their summer reading programs, and we've had a shift in the past. The state is pushing more towards summer learning, which incorporates reading, but it's much more. And so this falls perfectly into that, where you might have a child that really doesn't want to read or doesn't have an interest in that. So this might help those reluctant readers where, yes, you are technically still reading a field guide or you're reading a map, which is a skill that a lot of kids might not actually have these days. So, I mean, they're getting out, they're exploring, they're learning, and they're being active. So it's something that I think it does help, and it maybe encourages more nature exploration instead of just sitting playing a game or doing an app or something. So,
well, speaking of an app, there actually is a tech component to this, right?
There is. And we had initially thought about really pushing that piece of it, but kind of pulled back. Same thing. We didn't know if all our patrons would have access to technology, and we weren't really keen on putting an iPad in the bag when it's going out around ponds and in the woods. So the app is called Seek. And it's really great. I actually use it myself now, and I'm obsessed with it. But kids can be a citizen scientist almost and use the app and go out, and they can take pictures of pretty much anything they're looking at, a plant, a bug. And then it tracks it, and it shows how many of that species have been tracked in whatever neighborhood or area you are at. And then it also helps with invasive species, because mm-hmm. it shows you if the species is native or not. So then that's great. They can see where those invasive species are.
Are there any incentives then for students in Allegheny County to participate longer term, or to maybe engage with the library itself as they pick up these backpacks? Mm-hmm.
So that was also a big goal of this project, was to get kids connected with the Allegheny County parks, with the land trust properties. But then we thought transportation could also be a barrier, and that we didn't want to exclude anyone from that. So we thought it would be better to incentivize them by the themes. So if they took one sub-theme within each theme out, then we'd give them a little prize at the end. At the beginning, they'll get a nature passport that lists all of the themes and the sub-themes underneath that. And then it also has a little blurb that says beyond backyard exploration. So if they are able to go to one of these properties, then it shows where you might see some of that there. And then once they complete that, they go in and they get a stamp every time they complete it. And then they'll get a Fundana bandana, which is actually really cool. And the Land Trust recommended it. And it's a bandana with information on it about different themes. Most of them are a scavenger hunt. So then it's forcing them to go outside and even explore more and learn about a specific topic.
Very cool. So how can kids get their hands on these backpacks?
If you go into the library, we have 46 county libraries, including the Carnegie Library of Pittsburgh. Only about 35 of them actually have a backpack living in the library. So those libraries that have it housed there are the ones that are participating in that Nature Explorer program with the passport and the fundanas. And any resident of Allegheny County or the city of Pittsburgh is able to reserve these bags and have them sent to their home library. The passport program or Nature Explorer program is only available to those libraries that actually house the bag. So you'll have to ask your librarian about that if you would go into the local library.
We'll have links to that catalog as well as the program itself on our website at WESA.FM. Carrie Lane is the Youth Services Coordinator at the Allegheny County Library Association, one of four organizations participating in the Nature Explorer program. Carrie, thanks so much for making time.
Thanks for having me.
You're listening to The Confluence on 90.5 WESA.
It's The Confluence. I'm Kevin Gavin. From ICE to the BRT to a downtown street study, it's a busy summer for the Port Authority of Allegheny County. And this is all after adopting a new budget. We're going to find out more about all of these developments from WESA's transportation and infrastructure reporter, Margaret J. Krause. Margaret, welcome back to the program.
Good morning, Kevin.
So Port Authority CEO Catherine Kelman told the board that the transit agency is not working with Immigration and Customs Enforcement officers to apprehend residents who do not have documents. What prompted this declaration?
She makes a regular report to the board at the board meeting every month, and she just paused to say, you know, you all may be aware in the news of increased raids and dragnets on people in the country without documentation. We just want to reassure our riders that we are not working with ICE. And she was asked whether she knew of any of the raids by ICE or anything like that in the Pittsburgh region. She said she wasn't sure, but there was no reason to wait to reassure riders. She didn't want people to be afraid before they were told that the Port Authority is a neighbor and a friend.
Were there any concerns that maybe Port Authority police were working with ICE?
Not that I know of. Mm-hmm. You know, a few years back, there was a question about whether or not transit police would cite people for non-fare payment. And that conversation has been addressed. But I think perhaps there may have been lingering fears about, you know, these are police officers. Are they working with ICE?
And possibly targeting certain individuals for not.
Right. That was the concern, that people would be unfairly targeted during fare enforcement activities, which, again, are not happening.
Right. At its meeting Friday, the PAT board took action regarding the proposed bus rapid transit project. What exactly did the board do?
Sure. So this is a proposed cooperation agreement that would replace a memorandum of understanding that was signed in 2014. Basically, what it does is it says all these people, originally the Urban Redevelopment Authority was the lead in applying for federal funding for the bus rapid transit system. Basically, what this does, it makes Port Authority the lead applicant, and it also lays out responsibilities of all the parties.
Briefly, remind us, it's been a while since BRT was proposed.
Oh,
where would it go?
It's been in the background, though. It would run between downtown and Oakland on dedicated lanes, and then from Oakland continue on to Highland Park, Greenfield, and then communities in the Mon Valley.
Mm-hmm. You reported that PAT officials are confident that federal funding will be awarded. What, if any, signals did they receive from the feds that would, you know, help them express this confidence?
It has consistently received high rankings. So there are tons of projects across the country that apply for this grant funding. And there's planning stages, there's design stages, but they have been ranked in this Small Starts grant program very highly. And really, Kellerman said that the main holdup has just been getting those commitment letters, turning it in, saying, here, federal government, as you can see, we're ready to hit the ground running. Please give us money.
All right. So last September, I think it was, they did a renewal of an application, and now they're going to do another application?
Yes.
Why? What's needed?
They need signed commitment letters from the city and the county that say, we've got our checkbooks ready. Everyone's ready to move forward. And they also needed the Port Authority. It's a transit project. They needed the transit agency to be the lead applicant.
All right. So they do have commitments for federal or local and state funding?
We have been told that they will have those before August 23rd, and that's when they'll resubmit.
Okay. In our last minute, Port Authority aboard, I believe they approved going forward with a downtown streets study.
Yes.
How would that affect the Port Authority?
So it will give Port Authority a much better sense of how people move through downtown. Walking, biking, transit, rideshare, you know, food delivery. So there's a lot going on downtown. How do people move through it? How can they adjust their service beyond BRT to address and reduce congestion downtown?
Does PAT want bus-only roads?
I don't feel confident commenting on that. I don't know.
Okay.
I do not know. There are a lot of mobility things shaking in the city of Pittsburgh. We've got city council and residents taking up autonomous vehicles, and what does that really mean for road design? The city just announced the Pittsburgh Mobility Collective, which will have a number of different companies working with the city, working with Healthy Ride, working with Port Authority to provide other means of transit. So this is all coming about at the same time.
And all these elements will play into this year-long study.
Yes.
Margaret J. Krause is WESA's transportation and infrastructure reporter. Margaret, thanks so much for joining us today.
Thank you, Kevin.
And for today, that is The Confluence, where the news comes together. Next time on the program, for nearly three decades, the Pittsburgh troupe Squonk Opera has brought its melodic art to open-air festivals with big, surreal props. Hear about their regatta debut with Hand to Hand, a show inspired by the 2016 elections that takes its title literally. If you missed anything from today's program, you'd like to catch up on past shows, please visit wesa.fm/confluence or wherever you get your favorite podcasts. Today's program was engineered and produced by Kylie Kaczynski. Production assistance by Julia Zenkovich, Julia Maruka, and Hannah Gaskill. The editor and producer of The Confluence is Megan Harris. I'm Kevin Gavin. Until next time, hope you have a good day of good news.